You're listening to Pythagoras' Trousers.
Hello and welcome to this month's Pythagorean Astronomy with me, Chris North.
And me, Edward Gomez.
We're going to start off, as we seem to often do at the moment, on the red planet, on Mars, something hit Mars.
Yeah, something did hit Mars. Something hit Mars in an 18-month, two-year period. That's not necessarily unexpected. Between 2 and 3 tons of stuff hit Mars every year. So the interesting thing about it is that not that the crater is large, but there is so much ejecta, so much stuff came out of the little hole that was made and scattered across Mars's surface that it was picked up by the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter.
So this crater, you said we know it's narrowed down to about an 18-month period. So it's sometime between late 2016, early 2017, and about late 2018. And that's just because Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter takes these very high-resolution photos but doesn't see the whole surface at the whole time. And it scanned this bit of the surface in late 2016 and early 2017, and there was nothing there. And late 2018, there is a crater there. So we know it's sometime in that window. About 15 metres across. It's fairly hefty for a new crater. You get lots of tiny craters forming all the time. So this is one of the larger objects to have, or larger craters to have formed on Mars. And as you say, the ejecta that's splattered out of the crater is created this nice dark smudge.
Yeah, which is about 20 or 30 times bigger than the crater itself. So it's actually really quite obvious. Mm. If it had just been the crater, the researchers looking at the data probably wouldn't have noticed. Mm.
And the crater itself is, of course, much bigger than the thing that hit. So the thing that hit would have been relatively small to make a 15-metre crater. I mean, typically these things are 10 to 30 times bigger than the thing that hits, right? That's about the...
That's right, yeah. It probably would have been the size of a large rock, a pebble, you know, something you could pick up with your hand, probably.
Yeah. So if that came into the Earth's atmosphere, we'd see a bright fireball in the sky, I'd have thought, sort of a small football brick-sized thing. You'd see a very bright fireball in the sky. Less atmosphere on Mars, so no fireball, which means it hits the surface really very quickly.
Yeah, that's right. And that's probably why it's got such a large amount of ejecta, such a big, dark smudge.
But part of the benefit of having these spacecraft orbiting Mars is that we can see more of these things as they crop up. So who knows how many we'll continue seeing. Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter has been there for about 13 years, so it's had a lot of time to try and find these craters. They do come along from time to time. And it does, the fact that the ejecta's there lets us, in principle, see the interior of Mars, because that stuff came from under the surface, of course.
Yeah, that's right. And that's really the job of the rovers. That's a lot of the rovers that are on Mars are digging down underneath the surface and examining with their little chemical labs. And some of them are actually not more advanced than just taking a very high-resolution, interesting picture of the stuff that they dig up. And now we have the stuff that was underneath Mars displayed all over the surface. So things like the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter can have a look at that stuff. And the fact that it's very dark tells us something interesting about the stuff that's underneath the surface on Mars in a region which is not currently being explored.
Mm. Staying with Mars, but moving into the atmosphere, and Mars's clouds. So the rovers and the landers and the orbiters that are at Mars see clouds in the atmosphere. They're made of sometimes water ice, sometimes carbon dioxide ice. They're very wispy things, much more wispy than the big thunderclouds we see here on Earth. But there's an odd mystery with clouds is how do they form? And that was a mystery for a while, I think, here on Earth.
Yeah, that's right. Clouds need clouds don't just spontaneously form out of the air. They need the water droplets need something to condense onto, like water that mists up your car. It needs something to condense on. And on Earth, it's tiny grains of salt normally, or it can be other things, but very, very small particles. And on Mars, it's puzzled people for a long time what that is, what the small particles are so high up in the atmosphere that they can form clouds. And recent research suggests that it is meteorites, or rather meteors, so it's very, very small objects passing through the very thin atmosphere of Mars that break up into a very fine sand-like substance that effectively stays in the atmosphere and never lands on the surface. And this is what the small bits of water vapor condense onto.
And I mean, I guess that might happen here on... Well, it probably does happen here on Earth as well.
Yeah, I'm sure it does.
The salt grains are probably a much bigger source here on Earth. So that tells us where the clouds or how the clouds are forming. I guess in principle, one could then look at... Can we look at how much material must be hitting Mars to cause those clouds and so on? You could study this in more detail, I suppose, if we had the data.
That's right, yeah. And remember, Mars has a very thin atmosphere, so it's only very, very small things that are coming into the atmosphere that can have this effect, because larger things don't get broken up as much as they would on when they travel through Earth's atmosphere.
Now, one of the reasons Mars doesn't have a very thick atmosphere is because it's thought that it was blasted away, effectively, or eroded away by the sun early on in the solar system's history, a few billion years ago. That it used to have a thicker atmosphere and it's now gone. The same will have happened to the Earth, but we have a magnetic field to kind of protect our atmosphere a little bit. And the same will have happened to Venus, which is probably what stripped it and made it a little bit or considerably inhospitable. But narrowing down exactly what happened has it's lost in the eons of time. The atmospheres have changed since then. It's hard to know exactly what the atmosphere was like billions of years ago because it's now gone. But it turns out there is possibly a clue in a somewhat unsurprising place, which is on the moon. And the moon is unique compared to those three planets in that it doesn't have an atmosphere, of course.
That's right. And so not having an atmosphere means that it has stayed virtually pristine since it's formed, with the exception of, again, meteorite impacts and people walking around on it.
Yeah. Now, the moon is thought to have formed from a massive object, maybe about the size of Mars, that hit the Earth about 4 and a bit billion years ago, chipped off a bunch of material that coalesced into the moon. So the moon formed from the Earth, effectively. So it should have the same composition. One of the things that's been mystifying scientists for a while is that the moon's composition isn't quite the same as the Earth. There's a few elements where there's not as much of them on the moon as there is on the Earth, particularly sodium and potassium. And so one question has been, where did they go? And actually, the solar wind could be an answer for this. And that's the particles from the solar wind blast away these, or erode away, evaporate away these what's called volatile elements, these slightly more reactive elements, and depleting them on the surface of the moon, which could give us hints as to what happened to the early Earth, and possibly gives us a hint as to what the sun used to be like.
One of the theories that people are exploring at the moment is that the sun rotated at a different rate in the past during this period where the solar system was bombarded by very high energy light and particles, and that the sun was rotating faster, and that meant that the sun was a lot more active. It had a lot more bursts of energetic charged particles flowing out from it, and that caused the irradiation of Mars, causing it to lose its atmosphere, of Venus to make it inhospitable, and possibly the moon as well, and that's why the moon doesn't have these extra volatiles on it, and that really could be the missing part of this puzzle of how and when this happened. And it was possibly around 200 million years after the solar system, as we think of it today, formed.
Now, we know that young stars rotate more quickly than older stars, but just quite how quickly the sun rotated, as you said, is one of these mysteries. It seems that it was actually if the results of this analysis are true, and there's quite a lot of unknowns that go into this, the sun appears to have been a relatively slow rotating star. Compared with other stars of its size, its mass. So it was in the slower half of solar mass stars, if you like. And that means its activity was probably lower. So that's probably been very useful for life on Earth, because if its activity was higher, we might not be here.
Yeah, exactly. And that's really quite lucky for us.
The other thing in astronomy that's been in the news recently is not something coming down to Earth or something being investigated on another planet, but things that we have launched, we as the human race. Specifically, a big group of satellites launched into orbit around the Earth by the company called SpaceX. SpaceX had done an awful lot of stuff with sending missions to the space station and reusable rockets, and it's like watching the Thunderbird sometimes. It's very, very exciting. This time, they've launched something, 60 satellites in one go. Now, that is a feat in its own, to launch 60 satellites.
60 satellites is quite an amazing accomplishment. This is something that I think people would have dreamt of. It's really on the verge of science fiction, this fleet of satellites. Although people do quite often launch CubeSats, which are probably about 10 satellites that get launched up together, and they are just cubes
they're typically sort of briefcase size.
That's right. Yes. And there are small ones of those that are about 10 centimeters aside as well. So you could get 20 of those, but 60 is quite amazing. And SpaceX obviously is the Elon Musk company that launched a Tesla into space as well. So this is where, once you've launched a car into space, where do you go?
Yes. The world's fourth electric car in space, I think, after the three lunar rovers.
Yes.
So the 60 satellites are there for a specific purpose. They are part of a massive, what's called, constellation of satellites that's being planned to deliver satellite internet around the world. So the goal, which is very admirable, is to provide satellite connections to the whole world. And the idea is that people in urban areas where there are maybe more affluent areas would pay. And I think the plan is that there might be cheaper or possibly free, I'm not sure, internet connections for parts of the world that currently struggle for internet connectivity. So that is all a good thing, I think.
Yeah, that's right. If you live in rural parts of even the UK, you can suffer from really terrible internet speeds. And with a lot of services which would have traditionally been able to do in local shops, like banking and local post office and things, being shut down, having internet connectivity is absolutely essential now. And there is, when you look at the developing world, places in Africa are actually remarkably well connected through mobile networks and not through broadband. And so satellite is really the obvious extension of that, to get very good satellite coverage.
Yeah, and it's important for education as well. There's so many things in education that are used in places, like you say, rural Africa, that you need the internet for. To be able to access. So that's a good thing. Now, the downside is that this was one launch of 60 satellites. It's the first 60 in what's planned to be, I've heard reports of either 7,000 or 12,000 satellites. Now, that is a lot. To put it into context, it's thought that there have been something like 6,000 to 8,000 satellite launches over the past 60 years, and there are something like 1,000 to 2,000 satellites operating up there now. This is 12,000 satellites over the next few years.
Yeah, they're considerably smaller than a lot of the satellites that exist, but still, that is an awful lot of space junk up there. Yeah. And that poses a lot of problems for missions that have to go through that. You have to track each one of those. So it's a phenomenon known as space situational awareness. Mm. You have to know where each one of those 12,000 satellites is at any one time. So not only that, when you launch things through this beehive of satellites, that you don't collide with them, but also so that satellites that, how shall I put it, that are there but no one will admit to, don't collide with it, and it doesn't cause problems with those. So spy satellites particularly. Yeah.
And also because you don't want to launch a mission that might have little bits of debris come off it, explosive bolts or whatever, although the debris coming off those is less and less. And then those impact something in this constellation of satellites as well. You want to be aware of that. The other thing that's been noticed down here on Earth is that initially when these launched, they were all launched together and they spread out like a thin line. And so the day or two after they launched, people would go out in their back gardens and see this line of lights go over their head. Now, they weren't horrifically bright, but they were as bright as, an average brightness star, if you like, to the up in the sky. Now, their orbits are being raised, so they will get dimmer, and they're going to tilt their solar... They are tilting their solar panels away. So they have got dimmer than they were. But there are concerns that if there are 12,000 of these, that's a lot of moving objects in the sky. So anyone trying to find asteroids, such as yourselves at Las Cumbres Observatory, or trying to track asteroids, or comets, or generally just do any astronomy, they find something in their image... Be able to rule out that being a satellite becomes harder and harder because there are so many. That's a concern for astronomy.
It is. It's less of a concern if their orbits are known, because it'll be on an orbit with the Earth at the centre and not the Sun at the centre, as the majority of the things that we're looking at are. If we're looking at asteroids that have the Earth at the centre of their orbit, then we're in a little bit of a difficult situation. But they do, if you only take a few observations, they do actually look like they are, they could be going around the Sun. And so that does cause this problem that I imagine as we study, as we, in the years to come, as we continue to monitor, follow up and discover near-Earth objects, asteroids and other solar system phenomena, we will get an awful lot of these satellites causing us problems.
The other aspect of these satellites is, as well as them reflecting the sunlight, which means that astronomers, amateur and professional, might see them in their images, to do the internet connection, they use radio waves. They use something in the Ku band, a particular band of radio waves. And that means that for anyone trying to do radio astronomy, there is, in principle, this very, very bright light in the sky in radio waves. Now, there are certain regimes of the radio wave spectrum which are reserved for astronomy, and they will stay outside of those. But it's still, that again, is something that radio astronomers will have to contend with if they're looking at a broad range of radio waves.
It's the ultimate sort of light pollution. It's lights in the sky stopping you from seeing very faint things very far away.
And no matter where you go in the world, you can go away from all the cities you like. These satellites, by definition, are covering the entire planet. Now, you might call them Twitter spats online with astronomers complaining, and Elon Musk, the CEO of SpaceX, coming back, saying that he wants to make sure that they aren't they don't impact astronomy too much. There were some clear misunderstandings about the impact of satellites on astronomy, quite how many there are up there and what an impact they have. But fingers crossed this can be sorted and they don't make the impacts that are feared they might, while at the same time delivering global internet connectivity, which is, I guess, the goal here.
Let's hope so.
One of the things we've learned in astronomy over the last century or so is how galaxies seem to change and how they evolve over their lifetimes. At least we thought we had. There's some results come out from a group called the Zooniverse, which is a group of scientists joined by an awful lot of other people trying to uncover various mysteries of the universe, the world around us. And I'm joined by Professor Chris Lintott, who is, I guess, chief zookeeper. Is that the phrase you go by, Chris?
That will do nicely,
So welcome to the programme. First of all, the Zooniverse has an awful lot of projects. We might touch on those later. But this latest one about looking at spiral galaxies, what have you been trying to find out with that?
Well, we're trying to understand how the galaxies that we see around us, galaxies like our Milky Way, sort of systems of maybe a few hundred billion stars or so, have changed and evolved over the last 13.8 billion years of cosmic history. And you can either do that by staring at very distant galaxies and seeing how things were in the past, or doing the kind of science I like to do, which is sort of galactic archaeology, looking around us, seeing what we can find, and then using what we do dig up to tell the stories of the last 13 billion years or so. The crucial piece of information that you've got when you look at a galaxy in this way is its shape. The shape of a galaxy tells you about its history. And because we have now nearly a million galaxies labeled in great detail with the help of more than a million volunteers from around the world, then we're able to sort of disentangle all sorts of things about galaxy histories. And that's where this new result comes from.
So when you look at a galaxy, a picture is taken with a telescope.
It is a telescope in New Mexico in this case, yep.
Excellent. So that takes, I'm guessing, a lot of pictures.
Yes, lots of galaxies. So the telescope in question for 8 years did nothing but let the sky turn over it, and it recorded the position of about 300 million objects, and about a million of those were faint, fuzzy things that we recognise as galaxies. In this case, we're looking at what we call disk or spiral galaxies. So galaxies come in two shapes, really. They're big balls of stars called ellipticals. We've got rid of those. Or sort of pancake-like things like our own Milky Way. And that's what we're looking at here. Now, when you look at a disk galaxy, you see these beautiful spiral arms. They're so beautiful that astronomers sometimes call these grand design spirals. And sometimes you see a bulge of stars at the center. So one way of visualizing this, which I'll steal from the late, great Patrick Moore, is if you imagine two fried eggs clapped back to back, you've got the disk, which is the white bit, and then the yolk would be the bulge at the center of the galaxy. So you've got this thin pancake and then maybe a bulge in the center.
And the size of that bulge, or the yolk, varies between galaxies.
It does. That's right, yeah. One of the reasons we think that is because the one way to create a bulge is to merge with another galaxy. If you smash two galaxies together, then stars get kicked up out of the disk and they end up in the bulge. So the size of the bulge, one of the things that's telling you is about how the galaxies have merged. But this is where the surprise came in. Going right back 100 years or so, astronomers, and if you take an astronomy textbook and have a look, it'll tell you that the size of the bulge is related to how tightly wound the spiral arms are. So sort of how curled up the galaxy is. And what this new result, because we had 250,000 reliably classified galaxies, what we were able to show is that those two things don't have anything to do with each other whatsoever. So you get galaxies with tight spiral arms and big bulges, and you get equally galaxies with loose spiral arms and big bulges. And that's the exciting thing here.
So you mentioned galactic archaeology. So taking taking these pictures of galaxies and trying to infer what's happened in their past. If the size of the bulge isn't related to the spiral arms, what can you infer from that?
Well, I think it's one of the exciting things is that it means we've got twice as much information as we thought we had. If these two things always went step by step, then they're only telling us the same story. Mm-hmm. So the bulge, I think, is mostly about the merging history of the galaxy. It's about how it's encountered. The spiral arms, I think, are much more about what's going on now. We know from some other work that we've done that the spiral arms, which are often lit up with bright blue young stars, are places where stars are forming now, and they can interact with the fuel for star formation in the disk. So in the disk of the galaxy, you've got stars, but you also have gas and dust, which you can use to make other new stars. And I think the tightness of the spiral arms may be telling us about how the disk gas is interacting with the rest of the galaxy. It's also the case that the spiral arms might be telling us about sort of less violent interactions. To get a bulge, you've really got to smash two galaxies together. Something, incidentally, we think the Milky Way and Andromeda are going to do, our nearest big galaxy in the near future. But to affect the spiral arms, you might just have to swing by. So if you imagine two galaxies flying past each other, because they interact via gravity, you might induce some change or some alteration in the spiral arms. And we're really just at the beginning of this. I mean, it's not often in my scientific career where you're actually really surprised by something. Discovery is nice, and a lot of us plug away and get interesting results and find things and so on. But this was, we started this work because we thought we knew what the answer was. We thought it would be fun to confirm what everyone knows, that the tightness of the spiral arms and the size of the bulge go together. And instead, we found the exact opposite, and that's always exciting.
So I guess one of the things is, you know, if you're confirming or you went into this trying to confirm a known result or an assumed result, what was it that was special about this project that meant you could do this when people before this hadn't done this? Was it just just the numbers, was it? Or?
Well, having lots of galaxies helps because you can. It's certainly true if you only had a few galaxies. The obvious examples fit the pattern that people thought held. It's also that the classifications, because our labels come from the efforts of volunteers via the Galaxy Zoo website, which incidentally has new galaxies, so your listeners can go and help us out with actually the southern part of the sky we're trying to classify the galaxies from. But because those labels are from many, many people, we have not only a label, we're not just saying this is a spiral galaxy, but we have some sense of confidence. So we can say this is a spiral galaxy, and 30 out of 30 people said it was a spiral, so we're pretty sure. And that piece of information turns out to be really helpful in working out exactly what's going on with the data.
Sorry, you must have galaxies where that's not the case, where it's kind of hard to say, and is that that's where the information gets really useful,
that,
I guess.
Yeah, that's right. But actually, the real advantage a lot of the time is the ones where you can make a good guess, but you're not sure. So there's a lot of information in galaxies which are faint or distant, and so you can sort of make out a spiral arm, but you're not sure, for example. Mm. Bringing those into the mix, you may not be sure about that particular galaxy, but if you have 10 of them, and you're 70% sure there's a spiral, then you can say, look, I've got my pop 10. Seven of these are probably spiral, and I don't know which. And that sort of information about a population of galaxies turns out to be really useful. I also think that it's just possible that no one's tried to make this plot for a while. It's such a well-established result that I wouldn't be surprised if no one else had tried to systematically check it, or at least not properly.
So just taking it as written in the textbooks, as you said.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've lost count of the number of talks I've given over the years in which I've shown past results and explained to people that the bulge and the spiral arms go together without even thinking of checking. So it's a lesson, perhaps, that we should all go and make sure we've got our foundations right before we go and build big houses of cards on top of them.
Now, those foundations, you mentioned textbooks. When different types of galaxies were first being classified early in the 20th century, I guess, was the big work that was done by people like Edwin Hubble did a lot of work, and others as well, to group them into types and to try and get some logic behind them. We knew about different shapes, but there was this idea that there was this progression of different shapes of galaxies as a galaxy changed over time. That then got turned on its head. So we used to think that ellipticals turn into spiral galaxies or disk galaxies. And now we think that, or then for a while, we thought that these disk galaxies turn into elliptical galaxies when they merge together. Does this research say anything about that? Does it say we might have to throw that out the window? Or
I don't think so. I mean, this is a field, whenever we think about galaxies, I think we're finding that things are much more complicated than we thought. Whenever somebody says either this effect or that effect is responsible, we almost always seem to find that the answer is both. and that these things are... Although, I think this is partly an error in how we think about a galaxy. So let's go right back. If we're doing history, go back to the 19th century when people were arguing about whether these faint, fuzzy things in the sky were systems in their own right, or whether they were part of what we'd call the Milky Way. These often got called island universe theories. So the idea that your galaxy, which has hundreds of billions of stars, as I said, would be essentially isolated. It's sitting on its own, sort of large enough and important enough to just be its own master of its domain, I guess is what I'm saying. And mergers happened, but they were seen as rare, and they were seen as spectacular and life-changing for the galaxy. So as you say, one way to turn a spiral galaxy into an elliptical galaxy is to smash it with another spiral galaxy. And some of the time, that will produce a merger. But we've known for a while that that result's wrong. If you look at the big simulations of cosmology that sort of model the universe as a whole, you find that old picture, it needs to be thrown out. Galaxies interact all the time. They're aware of their environment. So whether if your galaxy lives in a very empty region of the universe, a place called a void, for example, then it will have a different life, and it will grow and change differently from a galaxy in the center of a dense cluster. And mergers turn out to be common. So galaxies the size of the Milky Way, or the mass of the Milky Way, I should say, have on average had 2 to 3 big mergers in the past. But those mergers have turned out to be slightly less important than we thought. They're a bit like a fireworks display. They look spectacular, but when you come back the next morning, there's not much left to see, and not much has changed. So I think this is a reminder that we've really got to work hard to change our mental picture. The universe is a dynamic place. Galaxies interact with their surroundings and with each other. Traffic in all sorts of directions is possible. So I think of it as another reminder that things are complicated, rather than throwing things out. One thing I do want to see that we might have to get rid of is the most famous diagram in galaxy evolution. So as you say, the person who put the systematic study of galaxy shape on the map was Edwin Hubble, the man for whom the Space Telescope is named, of course. He's most famous now for laying the groundwork for what we know as the Big Bang Theory. But if you read his writings, he wasn't that interested in cosmology. He's much more interested in the shapes of galaxies. And he wrote this amazing book in the 30s, which laid out a system for classifying the galaxy. It's called the tuning fork diagram. So you have at one end of the fork, you have a perfectly round elliptical galaxy, a ball of stars. Then you sort of have a rugby ball and then a cigar-shaped galaxy. And at that point, you split into spiral galaxies and barred spiral galaxies, galaxies that have this long straight feature at their center. And then you become progressively less wound up and your bulge becomes smaller, so you get further from the elliptical end. Well, that tuning fork isn't very meaningful now, or at least if it is, you need to know that what you're really talking about is the spiral arms. It may be that that's always been the case. Hubble said he was taking into account both the spiral arms and the bulges, but it's clear that modern astronomers, when they label an image and place it on that diagram, are paying attention not to the bulge, but to the spiral arms.
You said the spiral arms aren't connected to the bulge. So how do we think that the spirals change over time? Do they wind up? Do they wind down? Or is that another complicated thing where they could do either?
There was for a while a thing called the spiral winding problem, because if you make a simple computer model, the spiral arms wind up very quickly and then disappear. The simulations we have today show that they're more stable than that. So I don't think they'll disappear. But I think they can be affected by the galaxy's interaction with its surroundings. And there are some rare cases where you see two sets of spiral arms in the same galaxy. And so those may be interesting. Basically, I may sound like I'm waffling a little, but that's because I think what we really need is detailed work here. And what we really need to be able to do, I think, is work out how stuff is moving. So to move beyond just looking at a static image of the galaxy and see how the stars and gas are moving. Now, we made a start on that. There are instruments like one I work on called MANGA, or a survey called MANGA, which uses what's called an integral field unit, or IFU. So this is, imagine a camera that can take pictures in many, many, many different colours at once. So you get a nice picture of the galaxy, but you also get a spectrum for each point in the galaxy. And if you analyse that spectrum and you get used to looking at this data, it takes a long time, but you are able, with luck, to be able to sort of disentangle how things are moving. Now, so far, that's revolutionised some of what we thought about elliptical galaxies. So lots of elliptical galaxies turn out to have disks, but not spiral arms, lurking within them when you look at how things are moving. It would be great to get to the point where we can look in detail about how the spiral arms are affecting their surroundings.
So we're learning a lot more about the way these galaxies can interact with their neighbours and how they might change over time and how it's all very complicated. But you've alluded to this in the past. You're not doing this alone. You've got a rather large group of people, army of people, a collection of volunteers. How do you refer to your big collaboration? How can people get involved?
Well, it is volunteer-driven. So it turns out that this task of looking at images and saying what shape, whether there are spiral arms, whether there's a bulge, whether there's a bar, whether something's just an elliptical galaxy, that's something that people are very good at. And you don't need to be an astronomer. You don't need to have any sort of expertise. You can just go to galaxyzoo.org and you'll be presented with a galaxy which, if you're there sort of early in the week, the odds are good that no one in history will ever have looked at that galaxy before you, and will ask you what shape it is. There's a little bit of help on the site, and each piece of information you provide is going into our databases and helping astronomers disentangle the universe. We're particularly excited at the minute, partly because we're using data from a survey called DECLS, which is of the southern sky, so galaxies that we can't see from here in Britain. But that's relatively uncharted territory, so we're hoping to find more various types of unusual and rare galaxy, like disks that have no bulges at all, for example, which have never had a merger. But also because we've tried to speed things up recently, So we now have a little robot helper listening to people's classifications. And the robot runs in the background and classifies most of the galaxies itself, but it can ask for help. So it will push to the site the galaxies that it most needs human help with. And so we've built this sort of collaboration between a little algorithm running on my student Mike Walmsley's computer and a crowd of tens of thousands of people. And we do need more people's help. We have a queue of galaxies to get through, ideally this summer. So if your listeners would like to go to galaxyzoo.org and help us out, that would be amazing.
And this is contributing to the science outcome. So, that, I mean, the papers that you put out, the discoveries that are made by the Zooniverse just simply aren't possible.
They can't exist without volunteer classification. So it's not just that this is a nice way of doing it or that it's better to do it this way. The only reliable way to get detailed classifications of shapes for the number of galaxies that we need to get results like this one is to ask for help. And so that's what we've been doing for more than a decade now.
And the galaxyzoo.org is part of the Zooniverse, which has an awful lot of projects. So if someone goes and looks at galaxies and decides that actually they don't find galaxies particularly nice to look at, I mean, I don't know why anyone would decide that, but if someone were to decide that isn't something that they like doing, there's just a few other things they can do.
Yeah, we've got about 50 projects live right now. So my own personal favourite is trying to find a planet using data from the NASA test satellite. There'll be some exciting results from that project, Planet Hunters, very soon. But you can also explore the Serengeti. You can transcribe some ancient manuscripts. You can work out how a steel drum works. You can go through the dead bird collection of the Natural History Museum and lots of other things as well. So yeah, I'm pretty sure the Zooniverse has something for everyone. I have to say the most popular project, though, is our penguin counting project, Penguin Watch. So I think that might be a good place to start.
Maybe you'll get a few more volunteers signing up and with any luck, making some more surprising discoveries about galaxies or penguins in the coming months, years. Chris, thanks very much.
Thanks a lot. Take care. Bye-bye.
That's it for this month. Don't forget, you can find past episodes at pythagastro.uk, where you can also subscribe to the podcast. Until next month, goodbye.
You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy, an extended version of this month's Astronomy Roundup from Pythagoras' Trousers, a weekly science and technology radio show presented by me, Rhys Phillips. You can catch up on full episodes of Pythagoras' Trousers, subscribe to our podcast and get in touch by going to www.pythagoras-trousers.radio.fm.